Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what types of criminal proceedings are possible for a U.S. president? What types of secrets can they keep? Who can they fire and who can they pardon? We spend the hour with two constitutional law professors who untangle these and other legal issues. Heidi Cotroser is a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School and the author of the book, Reclaiming Accountability, Transparency, Executive Power, and the U.S. Constitution, and also the articles, The Shadow of Executive Privilege and Accountability in the Deep State. Eric Friedman is Distinguished Professor of Constitutional Rights at Maurice A. Dean School of Law at Hofstra University. He is the author of Making Habeas Work, A Legal History, and the article on protecting accountability. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you with us. Perhaps a good place to start would be our current situation with the presidency and putting it within a historic legal context. Can we start, Eric Friedman, with you to talk about the indictments, the allegations of the president, his people, the Russian situation, the Congress members, and look at this kind of historically in terms of what has happened in U.S. history before that might give us some insight? What historically have we dealt with legally that gives us some idea about what we're facing?
Well, first of all, it's not unprecedented that people in the president's circle are thought to have committed wrongdoing, sometimes quite serious wrongdoing. You know, President Grant is notorious for that, but in many administrations, there have been allegations of criminality. And in a number of those situations, the president has been thought either to be involved, as in Richard Nixon, or at least to know a good deal about it, as in Ronald Reagan and the Iran-Contra case, which is a recent example of a problem that goes back to Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, where Aaron Burr thought that Thomas Jefferson had a good deal of evidence to offer relevant to his case, even though nobody suggested that the two were colluding in any way. So the answer to your question is, not only is this a fairly well-known problem, but in fact, we know from the diary of the first senator from Pennsylvania that on the floor of the Senate, one day while sitting around chatting, they got into a discussion of whether the president could be indicted while in office. And some of them said, no, you've got to impeach him first. And the others said, no, that's ridiculous. He can be committing crimes every day, and there has to be a way to stop him. And they had a disagreement on the floor of the first Senate about some of the very questions that we are noodling over here. So the answer is, it certainly would not shock anybody who set up the system to think that the president might either commit crimes or be involved in one capacity or another in criminal conspiracies. And there are, you know, a number of well-trodden paths to take and others that have not been as well-trodden. But it's not a shocking revelation to the system that such a thing could happen.
But has anything happened to this extent before?
I guess we're asking sort of two different questions. The one set of questions has to do with lots of friends, associates, campaign operatives, and so forth. And I would say both Iran-Contra and Watergate are of similar magnitude. The other very different question is the personal involvement of the president, how much testimony he might have to give on the one hand, and his vulnerability to indictment while in office on the other, on the criminal law side. And then on the political side, the prospect of impeachment or some lesser sanction like a censure resolution.
Heidi Cotroser, what would you add to that?
I would agree that the notion of wrongdoing surrounding the president or certainly potentially implicating the president individually is certainly not unprecedented. nor is the having to grapple with, you know, many attendant legal questions, such as whether a sitting president can be indicted, executive privilege, which gets at sort of my main area of expertise, which has to do with government secrecy and information sharing. That said, you know, it remains to be seen, obviously, the level of involvement that's being alleged, as well as sort of the nature of the potential, the nature of the potential crimes. You know, so it is possible. I mean, I think we see drips and drabs of the news that has come out. That does suggest the extent of this could go beyond what we've seen before, even beyond Watergate, which in terms of the scope of what was alleged, arguably doesn't go as far as, you know, collaboration with foreign organizations. But again, you know, at this point, investigations are still ongoing. And certainly wrongdoing itself is hardly new.
So if I were to back up Eric Friedman and look at some of these examples that you gave us, you mentioned President Grant, you mentioned Reagan, you mentioned Nixon as three possible places to look in terms of, you know, seeing some type of presidential misconduct. What do you think we can draw from those examples and from that first debate with the first Senate? What are the ground rules that came out of each of those? And what were sort of the results that we can draw from today and say, well, this is appropriate legally, this is appropriate politically? How would you look to those as guidance?
I think it would be uncontroversial to say we are looking at two separate tracks and two separate spheres. One is the criminal track, and the other is the political one regarding impeachment. With respect to the criminal track, it's solidly established ever since Aaron Burr and Thomas Jefferson that at the end of the day, the president is going to have to give testimony as a witness, and that was so well established both by Aaron Burr and President Jefferson and a number of cases that have happened of less fame in the intervening years, that the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously decided that in the Nixon case, and Bill Clinton didn't even try to resist it, but reached an agreement to testify not only with respect to his own matters, but with respect to Whitewater and others. President Reagan, Vice President Bush gave testimony with respect to Iran-Contra. And so I think it's pretty solidly clear that we'll make reasonable accommodations so the president can testify, you know, from the White House by video feed or, you know, in ways that accommodate him, but he's going to have to testify. And I think a lot of smoke and mirrors about that, and we'll tell Mueller to forget it. Is just that, smoke and mirrors. If Robert Mueller served a grand jury subpoena, I think on the basis of the Nixon case, we can, and all this history, we can predict pretty solidly that it would be enforced. Okay. Then the second question is, what happens if we want to indict President Trump himself? That is an unanswered question in the sense that whether a president is or is not immune from indictment during his term in office is unsettled. That's what they were disagreeing about in the first Senate. It's never been tested because no one has tried it. I have taken the position that it should be available as an alternative mechanism to the one I will be talking about, impeachment. It's appropriate in some situations. There is no need to disable ourselves by inventing a non-textual immunity. Other people disagree, but at the end of the day, it's a small disagreement because it's 100% clear, the Constitution says so, that after he's out of office, he could certainly be prosecuted criminally. And so you're really only talking about timing, which is why Bill Clinton, on his way out of the office, had to plea bargain to perjury charges. Okay, on the political front, there's the question of impeachment, which is a whole different mechanism, a whole different tool, and really designed for different kinds of misconduct. If Richard Nixon bombed Cambodia, lied to the American people about it, that might be an abuse of the powers of the office, but not criminal in any way, but you might think that disqualifies him to continue in office and impeach him. If Richard Nixon backdates his donation to the National Archives for tax purposes so he gets a bigger tax deduction than he otherwise would, that would be tax fraud. The House Impeachment Committee declined to put it in the articles of impeachment and said, fine, prosecute him criminally for it. But that shows why one shouldn't exempt the president from criminal prosecution while in office, because there are kinds of misbehavior, like driving drunk and causing a lot of damage and maybe even injuring somebody, that one might think is reprehensible and deserves a sanction, like, you know, weekend jail sentence, fines, and so on, but that don't disqualify you from being a fine political leader. However, that we really think you ought to, you know, make good for that. And so, as I say, the timing question of whether you could do it while he's still in office remains unsettled, but I believe that it would be of greater benefit to the public to leave both tools in place for the two different sorts of misconduct. And of course, certain kinds of misconduct will be both an abuse of the powers of the office and a crime, and that's fine, but there will be some that fall into one category or the other, and we should have them both for such misconduct as may happen in the future.
Heidi Kittroser, let's bring you in to talk also about privilege. I think this is something you've also looked at. How would you articulate the limitations, and how has it been borne out legally as we're looking at this situation today?
Sure. You know, as I believe Eric suggested, it is very well established that there's certainly not what one might call an absolute executive privilege. In other words, that Donald Trump, in keeping with the doctrine, the major case being United States versus Nixon from 1974, does not have a leg to stand on in terms of the case law to simply say, well, I'm the president and I get to pick and choose, you know, what will and will not be disclosed. So that much is clear. Now, as to exactly what that looks like, though, you know, the devil really is in the details, right? So would he have to testify in person? If so, can he set limits on the time? If so, can he set limits on the subject matter? If so, can he set limits on the place? I would not be at all surprised if he contests and you know, engages in a legal fight over multiple points of detail in that respect. I suspect also, I think the biggest, you know, kind of pushback might well come, even if we assume that, let's say he testifies, he sits down for, you know, a deposition or an interview or what have you. I would be awfully surprised if he was very forthcoming. And so, for example, one thing that courts have said in the past when subordinates, presidential aides, have refused to even show up in the first place when they're subpoenaed. One thing courts have said, including pretty recently in the George W. Bush administration, is look, you don't have an absolute right to refuse to show up, but you can show up and then haggle over individual questions. I could easily see, you know, Trump refusing to answer a bunch of questions on the basis that that gets into a privilege area. So there could be haggling over that. I would anticipate, you know, a lot of haggling over what subordinate must turn over. And I know, you know, taking it outside of the realm of the potential criminal investigative process, in the realm of congressional hearing, we've seen a lot of that in the past year. So when Jeff Sessions, for example, testified about a year ago, June 2017, I believe this was before maybe the Senate Judiciary Committee, and in a couple of other instances with other high-level officials, we've seen them show up to testify but refuse to answer a number of questions. And what was interesting was in several of these cases, they didn't actually invoke executive privilege with the potential legal and political costs that comes with. Rather, they said, well, I'm not going to testify because the president might want to claim executive privilege. And the various congressional bodies simply never followed up, so that kind of fell away. But, you know, I might anticipate sort of similar back and forth, you know, with respect to underlings as well as the president himself. So, you know, I guess the upshot being, I don't think the president or his subordinates would get very far in saying we have an absolute privilege, we needn't be responsive at all. But the devil really is very much in the details. And I would be very surprised if there wasn't a great deal of resistance and back and forth over what they have to disclose, how they have to disclose it, et cetera.
Eric Friedman.
There you may be seeing a difference between the legal process and the political process. In the legal process, of course, it's correctly described, and of course, and a lot depends on who the president is and who his lawyers are. If the president is Bill Clinton, who went to Yale Law School and had very talented lawyers whose advice he followed, then you know you can anticipate something like what's been described. If you're talking Trump, who has a record of it being as freewheeling in deposition, you know, he's been deposed many times during his business career, has a record of being as, you know, free associating there as he does elsewhere, it might be a very different experience. But leaving aside matters of personality, if the Democrats take back the House, you can certainly anticipate a bunch of congressional inquiries into subjects. And think I read yesterday that the Republicans have circulated a spreadsheet of 100 different areas that the Democrats might want to investigate, trying to, you know, panic their supporters into making sure that Democrats don't take back the House. If they did, however, then clearly, as was just suggested, you're not going to get away with this kind of wishy-washy nonsense. And if the president wants to claim privilege, or any of those people testifying, instead of saying, well, you know, Mr. Lawmaker, it would be inappropriate to answer your question, or I think I'll decline to answer your question, or some kind of nonsense like that, I'll consider whether I'm going to answer your question until the pleasure of the president be known, and the pleasure of the president never is known. You can certainly anticipate that the House under Democratic control, particularly with the chairman of the Judiciary Committee being my Congressman Gerald Nadler, a graduate of Harvard Law School, will push them to the wall a lot more than that. And honestly, I think it would be unwise to try to litigate any very extreme position with the result that probably you will, as normally happens in these situations, get negotiated solutions which result in the production of a lot more information than you have now. Generally speaking, in the congressional realm, you do tend to wind up with a negotiated solution because both parties are a little fearful of pushing towards an ultimate court resolution. The uncertainty means that nobody is quite sure where it would wind up, and therefore negotiations tend to happen. That's the most usual pattern.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What types of criminal proceedings are possible for a U.S. president? What types of secrets can they keep? Who can they fire and who can they pardon? We spend the hour with two constitutional law professors who untangle these and other legal issues. Heidi Kotroser is a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. Eric M. Friedman is a distinguished professor of constitutional rights at the Maurice A. Dean School of Law at Hofstra University. Heidi Kotroser, what would you add to that?
Actually, if I could pick up on just a couple things real quickly. So all of that raises, I think, two really interesting points, or relates to two really interesting elements here. One being, Eric began with, the kind of the loose cannon that is President Trump and his and many of his legal advisors, including his most high profile ones such as Rudy Giuliani, right? So in that sense, I think we are seeing something unprecedented in terms of the personalities. And it is true, absolutely, that Donald Trump, you know, as a businessman, he was pretty freewheeling in some of these depositions. Although that said, I did see a clip of one of his long depositions he gave as a businessman. And, you know, in his own way, he was pretty intransigent at points, you know, sort of bullying by refusing to answer certain things. But that's in tension with the fact that he loves to talk. You know, he clearly loves to talk about himself. And he certainly keeps claiming he's desperate to talk to Mueller, that he very much wants to talk to Mueller. There's also the question of, even if he doesn't really want to talk to him, will he be able to, you know, help himself and stop talking and listen to his advisors if he does get called in? On the other hand, you know, this is a White House that I think has taken secrecy in many respects to even higher levels than previous presidents, and the levels were already pretty high. So I think there is that tension as to in what way they're going to fight. And a lot of it, you know, given this White House, I think a lot of it will be unpredictable, dependent on the issues and even moods and developments of the day. You know, the other issue is, I think Eric's points very much relate to, again, the significance of politics here, right? Because we have the criminal track, but we also have the legislative track, which could be anything from individual discrete hearings to impeachment hearings. And in that, you know, again, we are seeing the limits of having a unified party rule. And, you know, that's not the way the system's supposed to be. The system is supposed to set up so that power checks power, and members of the legislature are supposed to identify first and foremost as legislators who will push back against their rival branch, the executive. Obviously, that's not what happens these days with the party system. And so it really is going to be very interesting to see what happens if even one house flips control.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting intellectual and historical point. The separation of powers envisioned by the framers having to do with the institutional rivalry of the branches and their different incentives has been largely nullified for some time by the existence of a party system, which the framers did not anticipate. They thought that there would be rival interest groups of various kinds, whether rich people and poor people, or Westerners and Easterners, or merchants and farmers, or whatever, and that those, you know, there would be coalitions, but they didn't think that someone who represented a poor rural farmer district would vote contrary to the interests of that district out of loyalty to some party. And I think they would have been shocked at the concept, and if they had anticipated the concept, wanted to think about some different mechanisms to control it, because, you know, that's plainly what has happened in, you know, any number of contexts, whether it's the failure to crack down on the executive abuses after 9/11, or more recent things, or, you know, things that happened much earlier in American history once the party system solidified. There are any number of occasions on which party loyalty has trumped what you might have thought was the institutional interest of the branches, and it's gotten worse, but it is a flaw in the system of checks and balances, really caused by the framers' lack of anticipating that such a thing would ever happen.
Yeah, they talked about factions, but they didn't talk about the size of the factions being like these gargantuan coalitions. You know, I want to ask you something based on this point that both of you were talking about, this political context that we're dealing with. So the Supreme Court, for example, we know it will be the final arbiter of many of these issues that we're dealing with that really are meaningful in terms of good governance, in terms of the rule of law, in terms of sustaining some kind of democratic process. So if we had this sitting Supreme Court, this sort of partisanship when Nixon was president, do you think we would have had the same result, Eric Friedman?
Yes, we did. He had appointed four of those justices, and it was unanimous against him, decided unanimously against him the day after oral argument. Warren Burger was not happy, but did not resist what was really the combined weight of the colleagues, and in fact, you know, put his name on the opinion, because the U.S. Supreme Court does have a long-term institutional interest in being perceived as independent of politics. And in any one day and in any one case, one can certainly quarrel with that. But in certain critical moments, like Guantanamo habeas corpus in the Boumediene case or U.S. versus Nixon, when their perception is that it's us against them, that, you know, you're talking about the independence of the judiciary, that's a and the right of the judiciary to conduct a full and fair hearing, and we need the evidence, well, then checks and balances tend to work pretty closely to the original model. There are certainly, obviously, some of them who are more sympathetic to executive power, some more sympathetic to legislative power, but they all of them love judicial power. And so, yes, that's one of the reasons I think that at the end of the day, if Trump wanted to take the business of being a witness to the Supreme Court, he would lose.
I'm actually considerably less optimistic.
Yeah, me too.
About what the court would do today. Yeah, I wish I could be that optimistic. I would feel much better and sleep better. But, you know, it is true. Eric is absolutely right about I think it's noteworthy what the composition of the U.S. versus Nixon court was. Nixon was certainly not pleased that among the, you know, unanimous members of the court ruling against him were some of his recent appointees. That said, I think that being a Republican nominee to the Supreme Court in 1970 or thereabouts was a very different thing than it is today. I think today we have these, NGO, public interest group intermediaries like Heritage and especially the Federalist Society that really work with, you know, through often from the time they're students, well into their careers, you know, work with, hear from people who end up becoming among the nominees to the court. I think there's much more of a focus, certainly in the White House, but also among those who advise the White House, such as, you know, again, groups like this, on whether a nominee can be trusted. You know, you often hear the refrain these days among supporters of President Trump and people who want a very conservative Supreme Court justice: we can't afford another suitor, you know, another Republican appointee who goes on to disappoint conservatives by not being conservative enough. So I think there is much more cohesion in terms of Republican appointments to the court these days, obviously because of lifetime tenure and that kind of independence. There's always the possibility they'll surprise. I am much less optimistic these days that there will be institutional pushback against executive power. And, you know, I think Boumediene is actually a very good example of this. It's true that in the Boumediene case involving Guantanamo detainees and whether or not they had a right to file habeas corpus, it's true that the court, in a really important ruling, ruled in favor of habeas rights and against the executive branch. But that was a 5-4 decision with Justice Kennedy the deciding vote. And I actually think there's an excellent chance, I would give it better than even odds, if Justice Kavanaugh he's not Justice Kavanaugh yet, but if Judge Kavanaugh were to be confirmed to the Supreme Court, I would give it a better than even odds that case will come out differently today.
I also suspect that issues of habeas are one thing, right? And then the other is this partisan sort of nature of politics now that is overwhelming the rule of law. And I tend to, now I'm not a lawyer, so, you know, I could be completely wrong about this, but I look at a case like Bush versus Gore, and I look at the legal reasoning of that and how it just does not make sense to somebody like me other than partisanship. The partisanship seems to be a piece that might overwhelm the rule of law.
A lot then, yes, depends on the lens through which you look at something. That is to say, it's true about the partisanship, and it's true about Bush versus Gore. There's no question about it. I mean, that case was such a disgrace that Justice Souter had to be talked out of resigning from the Supreme Court because he was so, you know, disillusioned by what had been done, and was only talked out of it by his friends, who said, "That's a brilliant idea, David. You resign, and who do you think is going to fill your seat?" right? But and so Yes, if it's partisan in that sense, rule of law is headed for trouble. If it can be framed as institutional, as checks and balances, and particularly the judiciary, then you're in better shape. And in fact, the winning strategy in Boumediene was exactly to downplay that, you know, our terrorist clients are being terribly abused and disrespected and rights violated and so on, and upplay you, the U.S. Supreme Court, are being terribly disrespected if you cannot investigate possibly unlawful conduct, and the majority opinion is steeped in the duty of the judiciary to investigate. But yes, it is not a great sign for the future that that came out 5-4. And the reason is probably less, you know, partisan than a reification of executive power, which really, to bring the thing full circle, is at the heart of this immunity from indictment of the president, which I ridicule, you know, as the king as law, right? Thomas Paine said the law is king, and I say, oh, well, that's the question. Is it going to be the law as king or the king as law, which is, after all, what we had the revolution about? And yes, that's no question, that's very much in play today.
You've both said quite a bit that I would like to just expand just a little bit. It sounded like, Eric Friedman, what I heard from you was that the only thing that might trump the partisanship, if it could be legally reasoned to be partisan, is actually self-interest.
Yes, and that, in fact, that is supposed to be the basis of separation of powers. Ambition must be set against ambition, James Madison said. In other words, when the elephants fight, the ants are safe. Every branch is trying to expand its power at the expense of the other branch, and that friction is actually good for liberty. And as I say, when that friction is removed by the fact that we're not going to fight too hard with the president or the Congress because of party control, that's when the system tends to slide towards a consolidation of power, which is dangerous to liberty.
I do think, you know, the way you framed the question, that it comes, you know, the question of does it come down to self-interest, you know, I think in many ways that does get at the crux of a lot of what we've talked about in these last parts of the discussion. And, you know, as Eric and I both said, what we're seeing as between Congress working with or against the president is, you know, what two scholars, Rick Pildes and Daryl Levinson, referred to as separation of parties, not powers, meaning that, you know, the branches, unlike what Madison and the other founders intended, are not identifying their self-interest with their institution, but rather with their party. I think that the big question that a lot of these last couple of questions get at is there something similar happening to the judiciary? Do they remain above all that? Or is there a similar partisan or at least sort of political issue-based identification? And, you know, I think, you know, again, I guess much like I said before, I fear that increasingly, particularly in the last 10 or 20 years, we are seeing a movement away from, you know, the Supreme Court sort of transcending politics, either party politics or you know, issue politics, such as, you know, holding dear to executive power versus their own institutional interest. So, yeah, I think that question of self-interest, what is meant by self-interest? Is it institutional aggrandizement, or is it identification with a party or a set of issues? You know, which governs judicial thinking, I think, is a big question.
Eric Friedman.
It's hard to disagree with that. and it's certainly hard to disagree with the concept that, you know, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. One can hardly get complacent that you've got here a machine that will go of itself and everything's fine, and all we have to do is sit back and let the Constitution do its work. You know, we are the Constitution, and it doesn't do its work. We do the work, and if we don't, you know, we deserve the consequences.
When we come back, What types of criminal proceedings are possible for a U.S. president? What types of secrets can they keep? Who can they fire and who can they pardon? Stay tuned.
Walked the empty desert and was burned in the heat. But the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. But I crossed the frozen wasteland, in the bitter cold did freeze. And the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. And I will knock on every door, for I do not have a key. And the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, I sang to myself that I wanna be free. But the road I must travel, its end I cannot see.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Politics and law have long been intertwined, but are we in an unprecedented phase? We'll continue our conversation with our two experts, Heidi Kotroser and Eric Friedman. Heidi Kotroser is professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School, the author of the book, Reclaiming Accountability, Transparency, Executive Power, and the U.S. Constitution, as well as articles, The Shadow of Executive Privilege and Accountability in the Deep State. Eric M. Friedman is the Distinguished Professor of Constitutional Rights at the Maurice A. Dean School of Law at Hofstra University. His book is called Making Habeas Work, A Legal History, and he's authored the article on protecting accountability.
Heidi, you mentioned a couple of things that I just wanted to back up and readdress, and this was about secrecy. And I know this is an area that you study and seems crucial both in the matter we're talking about now, which is, you know, holding power to account with a president who appears to abuse power, and also just in basic transparency and accountability of democratic functioning. So can you walk us through some of your findings with regards to secrecy, both in civil service and the presidency and the evoking of the national security argument that ends up becoming a cover, perhaps, for keeping more secrets?
Sure. I think your question alludes to there's so much to say about that. But let me try to kind of wrap it, I guess, into a short little package and say, I guess, a couple things. One is first, just to step back, step away from this particular administration or any particular administration, and talk about the different ways that presidential power, which is sort of the, you know, thread running through everything we're talking about, the different ways in which presidential power, particularly presidential claims of constitutional power, how they enable, help justify, exacerbate government secrecy. And then I'll say perhaps just a little bit about how that relates to particular administrations, especially this one. So as a general matter, there, I suppose you could say there are two big categories of constitutional, presidential sort of claims to constitutional power that help justify or exacerbate or excuse government, enhance government secrecy. One, you got it when you referred to national security. Sometimes these are called presidential exclusivity claims. Sometimes they're called presidential supremacy claims. But the basic idea is usually in the name of national security, though more broadly in the name of the national interest generally, presidents sometimes will say, well, under Article 2, because of the commander-in-chief power, because of the clause that vests executive power in myself, ultimately, even if a congressional statute, for example, says that I have to do something, says that I have to turn over certain papers, for instance, or even if a court approves a subpoena saying that I have to, you know, turn over certain information. Ultimately, if I know that it's against the national interest, particularly national security, I don't have to. And that can take a number of forms. One particularly pernicious form is when it takes the form of what some have called secret law. So, for example, during the Bush administration, there was a controversy about warrantless wiretapping, and there was a very, it really, really did look like the administration was secretly violating very well-established statutory requirements. And one of their arguments was, well, we had to do that because of national security, and we had to do it in secret because of national security. So then you can have effectively a secret system of law. Executive privilege sometimes takes this form, arguments in litigation called state secrets doctrine, that you can't turn over some information because it would be too dangerous to take that form. The other big sort of category of arguments that can exacerbate secrecy are unitary executive arguments. These are arguments basically to the effect that whatever power the executive branch has, the president has to control all of it. And so this can take most obviously the form of the president saying, I have the right to fire anyone in the executive branch for any reason. That might, you know, sort of deter people from coming out with information that the president would find embarrassing. It could take the form of the White House saying, we have to review any press releases before they go out, any government reports. That could lead to suppressing embarrassing information, for example. So that's just a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of the form that secrecy can take and how constitutional arguments can enable it. And I think we've actually, you know, sort of covered a lot of the ways in which this administration might use in the future, and to some degree has already used some of these arguments to exacerbate secrecy. You know, the one other thing I would add is that, you know, this is something every administration in one form or another, you know, it takes part in to some degree. But, you know, I think the trajectory is that secrecy and these kinds of arguments have hardened and exacerbated throughout the modern era, since roughly the end of the Cold War. And, you know, I do think there were a lot of ways in which the Obama administration was pretty bad about this, but I think Trump seems to be taking all of it to new heights.
I was going to say something like that, which is that the parties have been more than equal opportunity offenders, and you get a downhill trajectory. Every president tries to take it one step farther than his predecessors, and the result in many cases is things that are just inimical to the very structure that we tried to set up in the first place. That example that was given about the Bush administration is what Charles I lost his head for, the suspending and dispensing power. Basically, the claim of the throne was, yeah, Congress, Parliament can pass a statute, but I can, in the national interest, suspend its operation or dispense with it in particular cases. So in this case, the idea was, yes, there is a statute, and John Yoo and others said, however, because of the inherent commander-in-chief power to collect signals intelligence, we can go and wiretap and otherwise intercept communications regardless of statutory restraints, because I am the president. Well, you know, when Charles I said, I am the king, they cut off his head. So, partly because in the public and educational sphere, the liberals haven't been nearly as good as the conservatives in pushing, you know, their own account of history and structure. And partly, again, because when the power goes unchecked, normally you would expect the legislature, which had written that statute to restrain Richard Nixon, normally, who was making a lot of unilateral claims that Congress wasn't going to take, you would expect the legislature to push back. The didn't know such thing happened because the Republicans were in control of both houses at the time. And then, yes, this unitary executive, again, is a reversal of the idea that we, the Congress, make the policy and you, the chief executive to our board of directors, you know, executes it. Now, the concept, the executive power is in the president, is thought to mean, and therefore I will exercise control over anything that I think is an executive function, regardless of any concept of power sharing or novel institutional arrangements or method, new ways of dealing with problems. And that you've seen in this administration as in to new heights, sort of sustained attacks on administrative agencies, which have become the latest bête noire of this administration, and a theory that, you know, the good old days would be the mythical past prior to the New Deal, in which these agencies didn't exist. Of course, that's all false. They did, and they were invented exactly in order to improve the functioning of government. But, you know, if you don't think there is any such thing as a well-functioning government, then, you know, that shouldn't stop you. And a lot of this executive power in the modern era is not because I want to get the job done efficiently. It's because I want to make sure there is no job getting done.
Yeah, and actually on that last one, I just want to highlight or put a big asterisk, this idea of kind of decimating the administrative state. And just one facet of that is that Donald Trump has made clear his absolute disdain for the civil service. That's, you know, oftentimes, if you look at the context, oftentimes it's a big part of what he's talking about when he refers to the deep state. You know, the idea of anyone who is not completely and totally under his thumb, under his control, subject to being fired for any reason, including political embarrassment or dislike, that's a very big part of his agenda. And that absolutely is a manifestation of this concept of the unitary executive.
There are so many different ways this can unfold. I mean, clearly, Donald Trump is trying to control everything from top to bottom. But we know there have been leaks. And this is some of the material, Heidi, that you've looked at in terms of the leaks. And Eric, I know you've also looked at, you know, who can he fire? You know, Heidi, you mentioned he can fire anybody he thinks. But that could go all the way to where? Cabinet positions, you know, Bob Mueller. So let's take a look at, you know, can he fire anybody? And can he pardon himself? And these big questions that he's been putting forward.
I was going to mention this when we talked about him being deposed and being interviewed by Mueller and so on. Part of the fun of asking Trump, whether it's in a deposition or on Fox News, about things with legal implications is, since he knows nothing about the governing law, he's as likely to give an answer totally harmful to his own interests as otherwise. And in this particular case, I'm sure he's wondering why it is that Jeff Sessions hasn't resigned. He'll be fired if he's fired, and he can be, but he's not resigning. Well, he's not resigning because of a statute which you can be quite sure both Sessions and Rob Rothenstein know all about, but Trump doesn't, under which, if Sessions were to resign, then Trump could name any senior person in the Justice Department, of whom there are many hundreds of eligible ones, to be the acting attorney general. But if he's fired, then the position will devolve on Rob Rothstein. And he won't have advanced his ball in the least. And so there are statutes governing some of his powers which will be enforced. They are enforceable. And, you know, it sometimes helps to get good legal advice. On the sort of bigger picture items, I mean, look, the truth is the only restraint on power is counterpower, and that's the way the separation of power system is supposed to work. On the specific matter of can he pardon himself, that's another one of these unresolved things, like can the president be indicted while in office? On the one side, the argument is, well, the pardon power doesn't include that limit. It was supposed to be an extremely broad power. If the framers didn't think to include that limit, we shouldn't write it in. Some people say it's unnecessary to have written it in. The concept that no man can be the judge in his own cause is just, you know, wired into the DNA. My bet on that one is that if he did it, and if it were challenged, and those are two big ifs, particularly the second one, the challenge one, actually it would probably be upheld if litigated. But of course, it would be a limited tool. You can only do it, you know, on your way right out of office, because you can only pardon past crimes. You can't pardon future ones. And then once you're out of office, of course, you don't have pardon power and are liable to continuing criminal liability for future acts as well as for all state crimes. Never mind that if you do try to do it earlier, then you really do run into an impeachment buzzsaw. So I think that one is a less probable path. Although, you know, in the times we live in, I don't think anybody thought it was a probable path that he would be elected in the first place. So, you know.
Yeah, good, very good point. Heidi Kitrozer, what do you think?
So let me, just taking those two points in order, the first one being about, you know, hiring and firing, and the second, or firing in particular, and the second one being about the pardon power. So on the firing front, I guess there are sort of two issues. One is, what power does he have legally if this were challenged, if it made it up to the Supreme Court, for example? You know, what power does he have legally to fire? And then the second question is, you know, sort of what will he do given other constraints, political as well as personality, in terms of what he can legally do? So basically, there are a lot of open questions, but the Supreme Court has essentially, in a case called Morrison versus Olson, you know, has essentially laid out a balancing test, basically saying that Congress can pass statutes, and indeed there are a lot of statutes, including those that protect the civil service, you know, placing some constraints on the president's firing ability, but they can't go so far that it fundamentally impedes the executive power. It's basically a functional balancing test. I think as a general rule of thumb, the higher the level, let's say a cabinet official, the less likely that a court would say that, you know, the president can be constrained. That, in other words, the more likely that they would say the president constitutionally has to have complete firing power. But apart from legally, there's the question of, you know, other constraints, including personality. And one thing that I think is so fascinating, although maybe calling it fascinating gives it too much credit, I guess it's more just like watching, you know, watching an accident on the side of the road, about this particular president, is a combination of two things. One, as I mentioned before, he is very enamored of the idea that he has total control of the executive branch. I'm sure he is unfamiliar with the term unitary executive theory, whether he realizes it or not, he very much embraces it in the way he seems to conceptualize his role. You know, he sees himself, at least proclaims that he sees himself as being in charge of everything and everyone in the executive branch. At the same time, this is also a man who regularly, including just today, watches Fox and Friends and the Tucker Carlson show, whatever that's called, and then immediately tweets in response to whatever horrible things he's heard on the show about what his own Department of Justice and other officials are doing, and saying, oh my God, you know, this person in the Justice Department did this. Why haven't they been fired? Can you believe it? So there's this crazy combination of him sort of, at least in his tweets, acting as though he's just a helpless victim who's watching his underlings do these terrible things, and pleading almost for help in the court of public opinion, and a person who believes he can control everything. As to pardoning, yeah, I basically see it the same way that Eric does, that, you know, it, as he said, the text doesn't resolve it. I think there's a very good argument that core structural principles prohibit self-pardon, but I don't know how much that will really matter in terms of what Donald Trump actually does.
And I guess if we're being historical and perspective-wise, we do know one little prior attempt to restrain the president's power to fire cabinet officials. Mm-hmm. It was called the Tenure in Office Act, and it was passed after Lincoln's assassination. Lincoln was succeeded by Andrew Johnson, a Democrat, as opposed to Lincoln's Republican, a sort of pro-slavery conservative, who essentially Lincoln had put on the ticket as a ticket balancing thing, replacing Senator Hamlin of Maine with a real Southern conservative who also had a serious drinking problem and was generally no good. Anyway, so to protect Lincoln's remaining cabinet members, particularly Secretary of War Stanton, Congress passed the Tenure in Office Act, which Andrew Johnson promptly violated by firing Edward Stanton, resulting in his impeachment. And intriguingly, the U.S. Senate, although they absolutely hated him, and they were under control of ideological and political opponents of the president, refused to convict him a number of Republican senators, at the cost of their own careers, voted against conviction on the theory that it was indeed within presidential power to fire one of his own cabinet secretaries and that the congressional statute had been unconstitutional. And so I do agree with what was said, that the higher you go, the, you know, core, the inner core cabinet is are supposed to execute the president's will, and the president is supposed to be politically responsible. But with respect to other things, either farther down the executive branch or more novel, less traditional core functions like the special counsel statute that was upheld in Morrison versus Olson, a different rule has applied, and that different rule, I think, has been very good for the country, but might be at risk under newer Supreme Court justices who have, with their mother's milk, imbibed these ideas of unitary executive and power centralized in the president. Even if they don't happen to think much of this president, they do idolize the presidency, as Chief Judge Roberts just wrote in an opinion upholding a number of elements of the Trump immigration policy.
Well, Eric Friedman, Heidi Cotroser, what a pleasure it's been to host you. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, your wisdom, and your research with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Take care.
Heidi Cotroser is a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School and the author of the book, Reclaiming Accountability, Transparency, Executive Power, and the U.S. Constitution, and also the articles, The Shadow of Executive Privilege and Accountability in the Deep State. Eric Friedman is Distinguished Professor of Constitutional Rights at Maurice A. Dean School of Law at Hofstra University. He is the author of Making Habeas Work, A Legal History, and the article on protecting accountability.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
Well, I climbed the seven summits, and I swam the seven seas, but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, I fought in the jungles, and I fought in the streets, but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, once I had a reason, don't know what it could be, and the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, I sang to myself that I want to be free, but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see.